Hello, and welcome to the Consistency Project Podcast. Every week here on the show, we aim to simplify the science of nutrition, health, and fitness, cutting through the noise to focus on the principles and practices that will help you perform better, feel better, and live better. My name is Patrick Cummings. Usually, I am here with E.C. Sinkowski, but this week I am alone. Don't worry, though. Do not worry. I'm not going to teach you anything about nutrition. That's not my job. I'm just here for a moment for an introduction to this conversation. What we've got this week is a conversation that EC had recently on another podcast. The show is called Medicine Redefined. The hosts there, Drs. Darsh Shah and Altamash Raja, interview practitioners who challenge the norms and promote health with their clients in a time when the current healthcare system is broken. A few things they discuss. They didn't do a lot here. They talk about the nuance of nutrition and its role in mental health, the benefits of certain supplements and risks associated with contamination and dosage inconsistencies, personalized nutrition, as well as the misconception that eating healthy is always expensive. If you want to learn more about Medicine Redefined, just search for them wherever you are listening to this particular podcast, wherever you're listening to this, or simply head to medicineredefined.com. The link to that, we'll put it in the show notes. Without further ado, here is EC and the doctors from Medicine Redefined. Enjoy.
Let's first start out with any updates, right? It's been 3 years since you were last here. The world is always changing. Nutrition, fitness, what we enjoy talking about, lifestyle medicine is always changing. Is there anything that you want to update us on? Anything that you've changed your mind on or anything even that you're paying attention to?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that. It's been a while. I don't think a ton of my main opinions have changed. I'm having a hard time thinking if any of them have changed. That being said, I know I've learned a ton and like a ton of nuance, even within the comment, like calories in, calories out is a thing. Like, yes, I still believe that, but now understanding all of the different influences on that and even how to apply that with different clients, I think is much more nuanced. So I am happy that I took kind of a principle-driven approach to my nutrition because thankfully, those haven't changed. I'm still open to them changing, but it wasn't like I locked myself into low carb or I locked myself into some paradigm. Instead, it was understanding the concepts. So those really haven't changed. But certainly my nuance about them has changed. And hopefully even just a greater level of empathy and nuance around different client scenarios that potentially I was just naive to, either being lack of experience or even just coming from that CrossFitter type of persona and demographic, right? So I think hopefully my skills as a coach has changed, but maybe not my understanding of what needs to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. To steal a phrase from a recent guest, Irene Davis, it's evolution of thought, right? And I think that I was recently reviewing your principles again in preparation for this. And I think it's always good when you're approaching things from just like looking at foundations. I think maybe last time we were talking about simple is sexy. And when you keep things very, very simple and focus on the foundations, you don't need to change, you can just build on top of that. And so I think one of the things that happened, so again, for the listeners, if you haven't listened to it, February 2021, right? So this is maybe on the back half of the COVID or middle of COVID. Since then, one of the things that's happened is a ton of people and particularly patients have gotten more of a consumer mindset and they've become more active participants in their own health. And we see this in our clinic. We're seeing this on social media. We even have more influencers and people with and without credibility commenting on nutritional things. And the volume of those conversation and the content is just coming in at just warp speed. It's hard to even keep up with some of the things that I want to get your takes on. But I think I want to start with something that I have no idea in clinical medicine. And I want to tell this to my patients. And we like to say, because it makes us feel good because of our biases, that nutrition cures all. But I don't think it does. And I think that's the kind of the role of nutrition and chronic disease, particularly with like mental health type stuff. And the reason I was thinking about this is because, you know, recently you had the really awesome podcast with ashwagandha. Ashwagandha is one of the hottest supplements out there right now. And, you know, we won't get too much into it because you will just link what you talked about. But we've had a couple of guests here come on and talk about ashwagandha. And I've actually looked into this multiple times. And, you know, from an anxiety standpoint, when life's getting really tough and sleep deprivation, other herbal ones that are really, really popular, of course, curcumin, turmeric from pain's perspective, rhodiola is another big one. And so there's these bucket. But in that episode, you know, I remember you mentioning at one point to Patrick, it's like, you know, if people really are at this point where they feel like they need additional assistance, then maybe they should consider pharmacological aid. But sometimes, you know, what I've noticed in my practice, sometimes people will come in and they're so anti-medication. Partly because they'll look at the back of the list when the prescription pad and there's all the side effect profile and that freaks them out. And so, you know, luckily ashwagandha's the back doesn't have that. And so they feel safer about it, despite saying that the unknown might be even scarier. And so they'll say, okay, well, what can I do? What's natural, right? Again, the appeal to nature fallacy. But then the other thing, you know, we had talked about is let's dial in the basics. Again, going back to the foundation, let's look at our sleep. Let's look at our stress management. Let's look at exercise. Let's look at nutrition. And I think if we eat healthy, we'll feel better. But I don't know if that's the case. Like, do we know for certain? Like, what does the evidence say about nutrition and its role in terms of how it's going to make us feel, in terms of like these mental health, maybe not even pure diagnoses like depression, anxiety, but just our mood in general?
From what I know, there's association studies that show that people who eat healthier tend to have less anxiety and depression. But the issue here with that is it the chicken or the egg? You know, is the eating healthy driving the better mental health state? Or is the mental health state driving the ability to eat and make better diet choices? And the same thing is going to be true with like cognitive decline, which is really interesting as well. Like, is the brain getting worse in its function, making the person end up picking worse choices? Or is it the better choices that are supporting the brain health? And so this is the problem with the association studies. We don't actually know which one is driving which. I do agree with you, though. I'm a full believer in let's see what diet, exercise, sleep can do. Let's do the full gamut of the whole diet and exercise. And then once we're there, have we solved anything or do we need pharmacological intervention? Because I do believe there's certainly a role for conventional medicine, and I don't think nutrition will solve everything. But let's see how far it gets us.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, I hadn't even actually considered the cognitive piece of, you know, with aging. Again, another a lot of people come and talking about brain health foods. Eat avocados, eat blueberries. I was recently listening to a really good podcast with Chris Hutchinson, where he had a gentleman come on and talk about how to improve your memory, and he had like the 10 brain foods. But your point about, okay, if you have cognitive decline, are we making poor choices overall? That's something to think about.
And even this is something that I loved about one of those studies I was looking at, because the MIND diet is the one that's been, it's kind of like the Mediterranean diet for health. The MIND diet's the one for cognitive function, right? And they were just talking about with these association studies, and they get their patients to report what they're eating on the food frequency questionnaires. Well, if you have a population with cognitive decline, how accurate is the data? Right? Which is super interesting to even think about that. Like, now how is the symptoms or even the disease state affecting the data collection and their memory?
Right.
Maybe just their memory of what they ate is wrong. Oh my goodness.
Especially knowing that recall bias is such a huge problem in even individuals without cognitive decline. And that's like, you know, one of the biggest limitations of that. So yeah, it does get really, really, really muddy. Which always gives me pause when people go out and make such bold claims about this is good, this is bad, this is what you need to do. And again, you can't scroll through Instagram or Twitter. I don't even spend any time on Twitter anymore without coming across some of that content. And the scarier thing is, you know, the more conviction you'll say something absurd with, the more time it's going to get shared. And it's...
Do you mind if I hop in on that ashwagandha comment, though? I don't want to lose this one thing, because I know you said the nature's fallacy thing, and I want to add on to that. Because of the lack of regulations around supplements, there is truly the risk of contamination or a dosage that we're not expecting. So a lot of supplements, and this is true of the Ayurvedic medicines, there's actually multiple studies that show heavy metal contamination of Ayurvedic medicines. So here you're taking this supplement under the guise of I'm going to get better, and you might be increasing your exposure to lead, mercury, and arsenic. I mean, did you see that coming? Then there's also the whole range of doses. Now, I didn't actually see any studies on ashwagandha specifically of how wide the range of doses are, but something like melatonin, the dose that's listed on the back of the bottle, in the pill might be -83% to +470%.
Yeah.
There's a selenium case study where the selenium supplement had 200 times what was listed on the back of the bottle. So this is where when people are like, what's natural and what has no risk? I'm like, there's risk, let alone the fact that we could deal with interactions if you are taking a pharmaceutical. But it's just like, no, there's risk here. There's actual risk here.
Yeah, it's just the known risk. Yeah, the melatonin stuff I've come across, and that's something that I'll always caution to my patients, because, you know, they'll talk about sleep all the time, and we have that those discussions. They'll say, well, I take melatonin. I take 10 milligrams of melatonin. Okay, you could be taking a lot
more.
No
clue what that is, right? Yeah. And so I can only imagine the same as, I mean, because you'll see these studies on multivitamins, you'll see these studies on different supplements. I can only imagine that range. At least there's some wider range than we would expect for ashwagandha.
Awesome. Let's, Darsh, do you have anything else on that? Because I want to switch to kind of physical health, because that's just what we see, right?
Yeah, well, I was just going to ask, like, what about the role of the gut-brain axis, right? A lot of people have talked about that. I think there's multiple books out there talking about serotonin levels in the gut and that being the approach to feeling better. So, you know, what are the claims surrounding that from a true mechanistic standpoint and, you know, looking at it from that point of view?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, is I truly believe there's a gut-brain axis. Do we know exactly what to change to cause a clinically relevant effect? I don't think so.
Yeah.
Because the gut is made of thousands and thousands of species. And we have some, again, associations of knowing, okay, these species tend to be what's associated with health. But again, is this the chicken or the egg thing? Is it that the food is driving the healthy gut that is then driving the outcome? Or, you know, is the disease state that the person has is changing their gut microbiome in a negative way? So we don't really know what truly is a healthy gut or what to shoot for. So this idea that we're going to now take some probiotics or a supplement to increase this species and have some clinical outcome, I think we're out over our skis a little bit, is my new phrase. It's like, yeah, I'm all for it. Look, I love it. I want people to feel better. I want to find the pill that we can all take and have the better outcome. I just don't think we're there yet. And the gut is so wildly complex to have this idea that we know how we can specifically change it to a clinically significant outcome for so many things is not there yet.
Yeah, there's a reason why a lot of these probiotic companies have this rise and then you kind of just don't hear about them after, right? Because, I mean, I think the research trials or whatever they're participating in just haven't really been shown to chalk up to maybe what they've claimed in the first place. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So, you see, I know you don't practice medicine, but you are a coach, right? And you have a lot of individuals who probably come to you and they'll talk about their mood or they'll talk about their physical health and talk about their goals. In fact, majority of people, like the physicians are the last person they're going to end up going seeing, right? You're actually the first line of defense, whether it's a personal trainer, coach, and that kind of stuff. And if they come to you and they say, hey, listen, you know, I've been feeling a little down or something like that. Disclaimers aside, how do you track people's mood and stuff when we're making these lifestyle interventions? Like, what's your process?
I don't probably. I run most, all of my clients come through my masterclass now. So it's a group setting and it's group coaching. And I do that for coaches that I'm teaching to teach people my methods. And I also do that for individuals who come through. And so the ball is sort of in their court to let me know how it's going a little bit more. It's kind of set up more like a class in college than a classic one-on-one nutritionist. And there's pros and cons of every type of coaching model. One of the reasons I purposely set it up this way is I actually don't want long-term clients, not because I don't like them, but because I want them to be able to handle their data and know their habits and know the numbers backwards and forwards. And this is what it means. And I just find that that works better in this type of setting. But that also means it's not totally the environment where I think a lot of people would share something along the lines related to maybe more mood or anxiety. Now, certainly they'll share, hey, this isn't so easy for me, or hey, 800 grams of fruits and vegetables feels like a lot, or I'm getting frustrated. But I don't know, I have a good pulse on their day-to-day mood, which you could argue is a weakness of the program. Certainly though, the more that I can read between the lines of the anxiety of somebody or that it's not going well and it's consistently not going well, the more I will suggest to them and to the group, have you considered going to see a doctor and that this is something beyond nutrition? Because that's sort of my fear, kind of getting back to your whole ashwagandha thing, is it's like, what if there is something underlying here that would be better addressed by someone qualified in that arena versus me trying to fix it with fruits and veggies, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want everyone to think that this is just going to fix everything and that they could solve one of their problems with a better expert in certain arena. So there are some times when I can kind of pick up between the lines high anxiety, and I'll just sort of say, I think this is a topic that's more mental health and maybe a practitioner in that arena, or even somebody will come up with them an issue, maybe lack of weight loss after a significant period of time, or even they'll ask about a specific lab value. And I'm like, that's your doctor, go see your doctor.
Yeah. And I think I'll just plug in for people, those who might be listening at this point, and say, well, you know, I think if I go to the physician, they're going to prescribe a medication and, and I'm not ready for that. I think it's important for people to know that there are other options that are in the tool belt of a physician. A good physician who's going to sit down and actually have a conversation with you and identify your goals. And it might not, and it cannot or should not result in pharmacological or prescription of that. Right. So for instance, I'll use an example. If you are having difficulty staying on your diet and you are having difficulty with the 800 gram challenge and you find yourself just binging on a lot of Kit Kat, which sometimes happens with me because now I have a toddler. That's one thing I didn't have last time we spoke. And let me tell you, that's different. Then maybe it's because you're not sleeping well, because you have sleep apnea. And if you just get diagnosed and you get a CPAP and all of a sudden you have this incredible control for your diet, right? So something simple as that, I think can be really, and you know, there's no other expert who can diagnose you with that. You unfortunately need to go through the medical system to get that. And so, yeah, of course, if you go and your doctor comes in and spends a total of 5 minutes with you and doesn't really ask you about your goals and your perspective on life, then maybe you just need to find a better practitioner who you can connect with. And that sucks because sometimes that takes a while. But that's another thing, that people just come in and like, I absolutely don't want medication. I'm like, okay, that's great. Let's talk about everything else, you know? So yeah. So I will say that to people as well.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I do too, because I will hear people get frustrated with their doctor, that their doctor either is, you know, saying that fruit has too much sugar or whatever the issue might be. And I'm like, hey, just find another doctor. I mean, I don't know how many, you know, there's lots of people in nutrition that are good and there's lots of people who are less good. There's, you know, there's chiropractors that are wonderful, there's chiropractors that are less wonderful. And so the same thing's going to be true in every field. And so I think it is worth, even from my perspective as a nutritionist, just encouraging them like, yeah, go get a second opinion or go into the third opinion until you feel like you've been heard.
I wanted to switch to talking about the role of nutrition in physical health, because you and I have talked about that offline, but I'm gonna come back to that, because I think this conversation about navigating information and finding experts and maybe even challenging experts, right? I mentioned earlier that again, nutrition information is coming; it's just an onslaught at this point. The good news is it's so readily available, whether it's podcasts, blogs, TikTok, whatever it is. And there are a lot of amazing scientists out there communicating. You know, one of the most popular episodes right now, I'll say, is Dr. Andrew Huberman, right? He's probably the most popular. And he has some incredible people come on and they have some amazing conversations. Some are like at the cusp and they're novel. Others we've known for a long time and it's just great information. And sometimes people will come on and make claims that are just absolutely false. At other times, it's like, okay, it's a little bit misinterpretation of the data. And other times, it's just absolutely false. And you and I exchanged something on Instagram recently. I won't name that individual. But the challenge is, you know that because you read primary literature. I know that and I read primary literature, but I didn't know that at the time until you had shared it. And then when I went to go look at the literature and I was like, wait, this is really true? But nobody else, I shouldn't say nobody else, 99.9% of people don't know that. And again, I want to say that I think Dr. Huberman does an incredible job. He's a neuroscientist at Stanford, and he puts a lot of great information out there. And chances are, at the time when that study was quoted, he didn't know the study, right? Because this other person is also a very reputable individual in the field of nutrition, particularly with children in his work. So I guess what I'm trying to ask is, like, who is credible, if anybody out there? It's like, how can the average individual figure out? Because if people like who are that, a neuroscientist at Stanford, like maybe they can't filter through that. Like, how do we figure this? Like, what are some guardrails that people should have when things like this come up?
Yeah. Huberman's a really interesting example because he doesn't actually fit my screening example that my screening criteria that I like to use. The two main ones that I like to use, well, let me back up a little bit. I used to suggest sometimes looking at credentials, but as you know, credentials, there's so many of them and there's different scopes and they don't always mean that it's a good information. That telling a non-expert to look at credentials, I mean, you could have a PhD in nutritional sciences and they could be way better than an RD who's licensed. So so I don't really use that anymore. The main ones that I like to tell people is, one, the information needs to come without fear. Anybody in the space that I look up to in terms of nutrition, there's never a fear thing of like, oh my God, you've been killing yourself for the last 10 years by going to the grocery store, right? Like I have yet to see an expose in a grocery store aisle that was accurate. So one, information should come without fear. And the second one, there's no gatekeeping or there's no secret or they're not the hero of this whole, you know, chronic disease epidemic. And that comes through in different ways. One, it'll be like, oh my gosh, I solved this, you know, and I followed this really specific diet, or it's like, you have to buy my product to get the effect, anything like that, or how they can't reconcile the fact that other people's methods work. All of that to me is sort of under this guise of I have the answer and you have to come through me. And anybody who's like that, I would stay away from. Now, with that being said, I have my own biases. I have certainly my own slant on how I like to coach people. I did create the 800-gram challenge, but I will also tell you why intermittent fasting will or will not work. I will also tell you that the 800-gram challenge is you're eating fruits and vegetables. So that's where I'm saying that, like, yes, I might have my way that I approach things that are different, but I'm also not gatekeeping the secret. Do you know what I mean? So Huberman's interesting because I don't follow a ton of his content, but I don't get the sense of fear mongering from him. And I also don't get the sense that he's trying to gatekeep the secret. I do think now thinking about that, cause that's a great example to bring up. The third one would be, just kind of more gimmicky stuff. It's like, you know, do you really think that the path to elite health is having this perfect circadian rhythm routine and like perfect supplement routine and that we're only just finding out about it now through this one podcast? It's a little bit of a reality check to think like, okay, the human species got pretty far with pretty austere conditions that I don't know that we need all of these bells and whistles to do pretty well. So you just helped me come up with a third criteria, but it's kind of staying away from, I don't think all of everything is gimmicks, but I think these marginal changes, which will have no clinical relevance to somebody's longevity and quality of life.
Yeah, I love that. I think the only person I've seen who's done a great job at the grocery store is Will Bolsiewicz, the Gut Health MD.
Oh, cool. I'll have to check him out.
Yeah. Only one who actually goes in there and doesn't do any fear mongering, but talks about what is nutrition and, you know, in the essence of it.
Oh, cool.
So as much as podcasts are getting popular, so is Netflix, right? I mean, the amount of documentaries coming on there, you've done a couple episodes or content as well, talking about how to filter entertainment from fact and fiction, right? So You Are What You Eat was a popular documentary that came out, which a lot of social media influencers, personalities are putting their critiques on. There's been the Blue Zones documentary that didn't come out too long ago, probably about 4 or 5 months ago. And before that was Game Changers, right? And all of these kind of have an agenda towards it. And I thought You Are What You Eat was pretty fascinating in the terms of how they did it. Because, I mean, they really lured you in with this study and saying, oh, both diets are going to be healthy, omnivorous, vegan. And then all of a sudden you just see them transition the camera to a farm and you're just like, wait, where am I now? What happened to the study? And then you're just hooked by what they're saying and they slowly bring you out back to the study. So, I mean, what's your perspective on how people should be watching documentaries? Do you also have a criteria for that where you tell someone, hey, this is how you separate the good stuff from it? Because everything is about context versus, hey, this is just pure entertainment.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's certainly, falls in line with that first criteria that good information comes without fear. And they certainly were trying to make you fearful of the toxicity in your food and the poor agriculture supply and that we're killing the earth and we're all dying tomorrow. So I certainly think that that's a good screen for that one to be like, okay. I actually think the Blue Zones one in terms of documentaries was a pretty good job. As soon as I thought they were getting a little too gimmicky, they're like, oh, this type of tea and they only have these tea leaves in this area and they brew it for 6 hours or whatever. They're getting like super specific on the tea leaves. And they're like, but remember, they walk everywhere and they have a good social circle. So they kept bringing it. As soon as I thought they were getting too silly, they kept bringing it out to the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. So in terms of documentaries, there wasn't a lot of fear there. I didn't feel like they were trying to gatekeep the secret or anything like that, or we have the only answer. I thought it was pretty good, but I think the other ones are really going to play on fear because that's how you get people to click. I mean, I'm actually working on a conference presentation. The most common cover slide for YouTube is the face that's like the shock and awe face. You know, it's like the, yeah, And why is that so popular? It's because people click on it. They're like, oh my gosh, what could be so shocking about this, right? So it's the fear aspect, the what did we didn't know. And so generally good information is going to come without that.
Yeah, I love it. The art of the thumbnail, right? We have to figure out.
That's it, the thumbnail, the cover slide.
I love that. And, you know, of course, we mentioned that you've been putting out amazing content for a couple of years now, right? You have an awesome podcast and you really get into the weeds of it. You have a co-host, right? And primarily Patrick's interviewing you. How do you hold yourself accountable, right? Again, we mentioned how messy nutrition can be, and there's so much context and nuance that's required. What's your process of holding yourself accountable when you're going through preparing for your podcast, when you're trying to put information out there? Because you also mentioned you have biases. We all do. Mm-hmm. I do. Like, for instance, like, I'll call my bias. Darsha and I talk about it. When a study comes out about exercise is good for insert issue, I'm all over it, right? Because I love exercise. And I'm throwing it at somebody, my patient or somebody. And the fact is, it's not always the case. So what's your process for holding yourself accountable? Because you're putting good stuff out there.
Well, thank you. I know. I cringe a little bit if I see someone's health improve with the carnivore diet. I'm like, no, it doesn't, but it does. Sometimes. I do think, again, coming at this from the principle approach helps, because for me, my principles were a way to think about, okay, as much as I like my message in nutrition, people were successful in nutrition before me. So I have to reconcile the fact that, yeah, some people have success with the carnivore diet. I don't like it. I'm not going to recommend it. But okay, why could that work? I have to think about that. Then I have to think about vegan. And I'm not against vegan, but I'm not also going to recommend it. But I have to reconcile the fact that people have seen results from vegan. And so I have to come to terms with the fact that I don't have the answer. And how do we have all this conflicting, in quotes, information, and what could be the commonality between that? And that's how I settled on my principles, which ultimately I would rather have more people understand that than necessarily my 800-gram challenge. I think my 800-gram challenge is a simple way to start enacting the principles, but ultimately the principles are the roadmap that they get to use and put in what they want. So that helps me a little bit. It kind of grounds me that I come at this perspective with trying to understand how all these different things could work versus necessarily having to be right. I think the other thing that I try to reality check myself on is, okay, let's assume I'm wrong. What's the outcome of me being wrong? Like, how bad is my advice, assuming I'm wrong? And, you know, that I think about it too. Like, what's the risk of telling people, oh, go ahead and take ashwagandha, you know, okay, the studies, yeah, there's some good data, you know, like it's promising. It could maybe do some stuff, go ahead and take it. And then I'm like, okay, well, wait a minute. What if they're on other medications? What if there's contamination? What if they have a real issue that they're not even addressing? So I try to think about the flip side or the counter argument as well to what I believe in at the time.
Yeah, it sounds exhausting. to consider every single thing of that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I think some of that came from my first job in environmental consulting, because we did litigation work. So you'd always be thinking about your presentation from how is the other side going to tear this down? And so now you kind of see when your life starts coming together a little bit, you're like, oh, that was really a good influence for nutrition.
It's funny. Yeah. It's amazing how we can learn lessons in the, what we think are the unlikeliest most of places, right?
Totally.
So, I want to come back to, cause I was, I wanted to get more of your thoughts about just nutrition and chronic disease. Again, I think in our line of work, we're both physiatrists, right? And we see a lot of individuals with, chronic pain, musculoskeletal injuries. That's the primary reason somebody's going to walk into my clinic. And luckily I've started seeing, you know, now that we're building more of a sports medicine practice, my athletic population is really ramping up. And again, they're coming to me when they're injured and they need to recover. And so, and one of the things, I don't know if you're familiar with in chronic musculoskeletal, like we do a good job in acute musculoskeletal pain, you see, but we do a horrible job of chronic musculoskeletal stuff, right? In medicine and the disease burden with osteoarthritis and just tendinopathy and that kind of stuff. It's just from a healthcare financial perspective, it's just overwhelming. And so we need to find better alternatives so people can get better, you know, shy of corticosteroids and that kind of stuff. And so that's where this field of orthobiologics, you might have heard of PRP and that kind of stuff mm-hmm. has really come in. But with that, the people who are at the forefront of that will also talk about, well, look, you can't have a successful outcome from these biologics, PRP type stuff, if you have an unhealthy individual. And what they're saying is like, pardon this expression, is like, if you're taking shit out and putting shit back in, they're not going to get healthy, right? So that blood and stuff. And the fact of the matter is, we don't know that. We just don't. There's no evidence. Mm-hmm. Right? It's PRP's been around for 30, 40 years, but we don't know that. But again, this goes back to our biases. Like anybody who's interested in doing autologous PRP is probably going to be more health conscious. And they're immune-minded. Mm-hmm. So they're like, oh, well, I need to eat healthy. So my platelets are going to be better. I recently had this happen with a patient who got an IV before the PRP. Familiar if that was necessary, but that's what so I guess what I'm getting at is like, when I'm having these conversations with my athletes and they have unhealthy dinner, we'll do a procedure and we'll say, listen, in your recovery process, it's going to be important for you to eat right and do this and that. Mm-hmm. And again, I think we've shared some literature back and forth where they talk about the antioxidant effect from vegetables and fruits and how that can help with the anti-inflammatory portion of it. But again, not really robust literature. So what are your thoughts about, how familiar are you with nutrition and its role in physical musculoskeletal health?
Yeah. You probably know more than I, for sure. I did do a little poking around because I knew that you're the MSK guy. So I was like, uh-oh, what do I got to know here? One of the first articles I ran into was, management of MSK pain, and they didn't talk about nutrition at all. So I was like, oh, it's all about the movement and then the various biologics and stuff like that. So that wasn't helpful. One of the studies, I think it was 2020, was looking at MSK pain and nutrition, but they included things like rheumatoid arthritis and fibromyalgia. They did include osteoarthritis. I'll give you the punchline now. Generally, more nutrient-dense diets seem to lessen pain. But again, that includes rheumatoid and fibromyalgia. So how much can we say, do we have a ton of data on just low back pain and eating healthy? No. Right. And then the osteoarthritis one to me is also interesting. Is that also just a little bit more function of a healthy weight? Cause we all know that, knee osteoarthritis is one of the biggest issues. And then maybe if the person just maintains a healthier weight, does that reduce some of the pain overall? And that can happen not necessarily with all these nutrients. It could just happen with a lower caloric load. So I think there's some confounding factors in there for sure. So I didn't see a ton of evidence to suggest that this type of diet is going to decrease your pain. That being said, I will say anecdotally, the most common response I get from people doing the 800 gram challenge is they feel better and they feel better in a recovery and a performance standpoint. And this is, of course, anecdotal. I haven't run the studies on it. And of course, I think my population is a little bit biased because I'm, formerly in CrossFit and functional fitness crowd and stuff like that. But yeah, I think something's there in the sense of, I think it does probably have some role in the recovery and helping them be able to not be as sore for the next session, which then can help potentially help their strength development, stuff like that. I also was thinking about too, even protein intake. Maybe protein intake helps them develop the musculature around the joint to support the joint better, to then reduce the pain. So I just don't know exactly if some of the nutritional benefit for musculoskeletal pain is sort of secondary to the fact of just strengthening the body overall.
Yeah. So I think the study that you're talking about was actually published in the Purple Journal, which is the main PM&R journal. And Emma is the first mm-hmm. author, right? And it's mm-hmm. chronic pain nutrition. We'll find it. We'll link it in the show notes. I do remember, right? So I think one of the reasons, so we talk about inflammatory arthropathy, such as rheumatoid arthritis, it's easier to measure all these inflammatory markers, right? Whether it's IL-1, IL-6. And so you have these clinical outcomes that you're talking about, these objective markers, makes it simpler to see whether they're not improving. But then again, even if the inflammatory markers are improving, does that mean that you have symptomatically patients are improving? And that's really what we care about. Because nobody comes into my clinic and says, hey, my CRP is lower. Nobody says that, right? Or my CRP is higher. They don't give a crap. It's how do they feel. And then with the fibromyalgia, again, another central pain syndrome, the osteoarthritis piece is interesting. What we learn about in our training is, right, for every pound that you gain onto your body, that's anywhere from 4 to 7 pounds of force onto your knee. And so now, is it with the healthier nutritional habits, density, right? Nutritional density you talk about,
Are they more full? So their overall food quantity is less and now they have weight loss. Is that why they're feeling better? Same thing with back pain. And so they, at this point, people are probably listening then saying, okay, wow, this is actually really, really hard. Like, what is it, right? What is it that's actually causing things to be better? And that's just one of the inherent challenges with nutritional research that we've spoken about. I think on our first discussion, you've spoken about eloquently on your podcast multiple times. And, you know, at the end of the day, I guess, really, maybe it doesn't even matter what specifically and how it makes people feel better. Ultimately, I guess if we're all in the business of just making people healthier and less sick and focus on healthcare rather than sick care, then we just, you know, we have these signals and then we just follow the signals. So I think that's another important point that sometimes, you know, analytical folks such as myself, I'm in academic medicine, so is Darsh, you know, we get a little too much into the weeds of the research and don't zoom out enough, something that you do a phenomenal job at.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I'm a very big believer in anybody with a health condition to give the whole diet, exercise, sleep a shot. See how far it gets you, because it might just be that. It might be the decrease in body weight that actually alleviates the pain. It might not be the anti-inflammatory action of the fruits and vegetables. It might be that we have less load on the knee. I mean, great, you know? So I think it's all really powerful stuff. It's worth a shot. I also, though, like to remind people that conventional medicine has a place too, that you can have the best diet in the world and it's not going to cure rheumatoid arthritis either. So we just have to keep that in mind too, that there's utility of both paradigms.
Well, let me ask you this, EC. When it comes to your clients, well, let me back up, right? So the audience has probably heard about this paradigm of good food versus bad food or clean foods, right? When it comes to a clean cut and clean bulk. And, you know, us three here understand that food is food and it really depends on how you use it and for what use. But when it comes to the general population and even some of your clients who may be more performance oriented, how do you talk to your, you know, clientele about this philosophy of good food versus bad food, and that if they are trying to, let's say, bulk up and get more protein in, they might have to resort to some of these processed proteins, like a lot of people say, these protein powders, or even, you know, for me being a vegetarian, going towards the tofurkey and things like that. At what point do we start to see that there's this more like risk than benefit when it comes to, yes, you're hitting your protein goals, but you might not be doing it in a whole food way?
Yeah, it's hard. And this is where I kind of come back to my principles in the sense of I want people to understand that the endpoints we're striving for is a certain number of calories, a certain number of macronutrients, a certain number of each of the micronutrients. We got to list out the 28 of them, a certain amount of fiber grams. And to see that your food is really just filling up those different buckets, just depending on what they have. And a lot of times in our processed food environment, we overload the carb and the fat buckets and we don't have enough in the magnesium and the selenium buckets, right? But I like them to get away from the idea of good versus bad food and start to put it together almost like that Tetris puzzle and figure out, oh, okay, like I do have room in my diet. I actually just had this question. He's training for the marathon and he was worried about having soda twice a week. I was like, no, you're going to need the soda twice a week if your diet's all, you know, pork loin and broccoli. Like you actually need those calories. And so to think about it as what are the components I'm getting from my food and how do they start totaling up in these different areas overall, as opposed to worrying about on like a food by food basis. Yeah.
Awesome. So let's talk about sustainable nutrition. And maybe if I may, I'd love to talk about personalized nutrition and really what that means. I think people, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts about nutrigenomics and things of that nature, the sexy stuff, the gimmicky stuff that we talked about before, because that is exciting and right. And tickles that, that part of my brain that just gets me excited about the future. But I also want to talk about personalized nutrition in the sense of how people can stick to their diet. I have a sense that you're going to talk about consistency or something. You really like that word. But when you hear that phrase personalized nutrition, what do you think?
I don't love it the way that the trends go. I don't love it from this idea of all of these direct-to-consumer tests that really are gimmicks and really the science isn't there. And when we look at a lot of the things that we're trying to prevent, a lot of these chronic diseases that people are worried about, they're these multi-polygenic, you know, diseases that if only they were so easy to be one gene, they're not. I mean, I forget, I think it's like 240 genes are involved with obesity or something. And the gene, the FTO gene, which gets the most press, that has the biggest association with obesity, I think it can account for up to like a 3 kilogram difference between the people who have the double variant and not, or the double allele and not. And so what that tells us is there's this massive environmental component that you can get all the DNA tests in the world for some of these polygenic chronic diseases. It's going to come back to your environment, your genetics, socioeconomic status, education, all of these other things that make this problem really difficult to solve. And so there was actually a really big study that did DNA-based personalized advice. I think they had 1,600 people in the study, which is like hats off to them for pulling off like a multi-month, you know, nutrition study with 1,600 people. And you know how science works, that the publication says that there was a significant result, but I think it was like, you know, the DNA-based group had slightly more folate or something. When you look at the results for body weight, BMI, waist circumference, there was no difference between the group that got DNA-specific advice and just the generalized diet advice. And so I think there's a lot in the personalized space that just capitalizes on these gimmicks that we don't have the evidence. Yet at the same time, I do think there's personalization by way of, hey, what foods do you like? What, you know, like, which fruits do you like? Okay, let's eat those. You know, like, okay, you're really into putting on mass. You're going to need more protein than the sedentary person who never works out. You know what I mean? So there's personalization in that sense, but especially the way that some of these direct-to-consumer tests, biometrics go, I think there's a lot of noise there that people don't need.
What exactly are they looking at when it comes to being precise? Is it the macronutrients, the micro, both?
On the DNA tests?
Yeah, like how are they knowing what diet to give? Is it just going to be a diet higher in protein just given the genetic tests? Or I'm just curious as to how they separate
those. That's a great question. And this is why you could go to different companies and get different recommendations because their geneticists are looking at, okay, well, which genes do we think are highly involved with this outcome? How do we want to rate them? What do we see in studies related to these genes? And then sort of make recommendations off of that. And so this is why it's not like, you know, you could go to different places and you can get different diet advice. Like, oh, this one actually was associated with a higher risk of diabetes in this study. So they might decide to weight that based on the quality of the study. Mm-hmm. But it's really up to them how they want to interpret all the data out there.
Got it. Yeah. Rather than looking at their recommendations. A disease process. Right. Mm-hmm. Rather than looking at a disease process saying, hey, you're at risk for high blood pressure or diabetes. Let's work backwards from there. It's really just looking at more of a microscopic level at this point, which, yeah, it's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, there's all those, and I'm not up to date on all of them, but there's all the genome-wide and association studies and the Mendelian randomization studies that I think are going to be really powerful to cut down on some of the noise out there of what truly is genetically driven versus all of this other epidemiology that, you know, while they're good, they're just associations that have a ton of confounding factors, as we know. But I think, you know, again, with these chronic diseases, we have so many different genes involved that to understand the involvement of each different allele combined with the interaction of environment, which is going to be so powerful, I don't think it's going to outperform, hey, let's figure out the foods you like, let's eat the right amount of calories, let's not get too obsessive, full stop, done.
Yeah, and that's the, I think, the strategy for sustainability, right? The diet that never feels like a diet. You know, I'll share the personal anecdote. I think a lot of times, you know, and growing up and going through exercise science, going into the coaching world and following people's work such as Charles Poliquin, the late Charles Poliquin, I remember he used to talk about, you know, there's essential amino acids and essential fatty acids. There's no such thing as essential carbs. It's like, oh man, okay, all right. So carbs are not great, right? And you work with people who are in the bodybuilding realm. A close friend, Joe Farise, recent guest, is going to be coming back. You know, we also talk about cutting carbs and, you know, getting lean and how that's the recipe. And all the people have these sexy tests. And I think one of the Poliquin methods is like, you know, they'll get body fats at different sites throughout the body and they might show, okay, you're creating, you know, more xenoestrogen. So then at that point, I'm like, okay, using the Tom's deodorant and using like fragrance-free type stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mind you, at this time, I'm sleeping maybe 6 hours, maybe 5.5 hours, right? Not focusing on those things. And so you get distracted. And I think only recently, and I have to credit Lane Norton on this because, you know, his phrase that he talks about, you know, you have to use some type of restriction because we're unfortunately in this society where everything is about convenience. Everything is about comfort. We move less. We don't walk to work. We don't walk between work. We're as sedentary as possible and even play is sedentary, right? Like it's more about gaming and that kind of stuff and not necessarily getting outside. And, you know, so you have to be very mindful of your every single decision you make in your life. And so with that, you are going to have to be on some type of restrictive diet, whether that's timing with time restricted eating, whether that's actually a certain macronutrient or, you know, it's something else. And for me, I've got a sweet tooth. I don't like giving up fruit. I love fruit. And so, you know, like this over the last couple of months, I've been quite successful after, you know, first 2 years of having a kid and falling off the wagon, so to speak. And at this time, what I've done is I've actually, like historically, I've always gone really low on carbs and that's been successful, but then it's not been sustainable, right? 16, 18, 20 weeks out and then we rebound. Another thing that he talks about is like, we don't have a weight loss problem. We have a, you know, weight maintenance problem. Right? And so with this approach, it's like, okay, I can eat all the blueberries, strawberries, apples. I eat 2 to 3 apples a day. I know they say one keeps the doctor away, but I eat 2 to 3. And that's, it doesn't feel like it's a fight, because also when you're restricting for that long a time, psychologically that's taxing, and the stress that comes with that, that's probably doing far more harm, certainly not sustainable. So I think that's another thing that people will come like, well, what do you think about this? Like, how should I approach this? And people get so analytical and it's like, okay, well, first I need to ask you 10 questions about what life is like, what's available, what do you like, what do you not like? And it all works. I'll add another one, you know, again, so lately as I'm, you know, I've incorporated some diet soda into my thing.
Welcome.
My wife is a pediatrician and she's never seen me drink soda. You know, we've been together for what, like 6 years now. And all of a sudden she looks at me, she goes, where's this coming from? Like, why are you drinking soda? This, that kind of stuff. I was like, it's fine. She was like, well, what about, you know, what about the artificial sweeteners? So I was like, all right, listen, you haven't listened to the podcast, have you? So, you know, and so now.
Let me send you a podcast.
Yeah, right. And so like now it's, I have a diet soda every single day. And, yeah. You know, and so the context is really, really important. And I think this goes back to the point earlier is, you know, people major in the minors and they're just focusing on the wrong thing. And unfortunately, with social media and people like diverting the attention, you know, and just distracting people on what's really, really, really important because it's not sexy.
Yeah. Yeah. I tried to actually change, I don't know. Can I say that? My goal would be to change as little as possible from what they're doing. Now, obviously, if they're very far away from their goal, we probably have to change more than somebody that's very close to their goal. But yeah, that's sort of the way that I approach stuff is, yes, I introduced the 800 gram challenge and I want people to get started on that. And then we keep progressing from there. But a lot of times people want to know at the beginning, well, how many calories and which foods are allowed and not. And it's just like, tell me how it goes. You know, should I do more vegetables or fruit? And it's like, tell me how it goes. Let me see what you're eating. Let me see what you gravitate towards. We're going to add on to that versus trying to give them all of these rules that don't already fit into their lifestyle and what they want to do. Because that's just it. Weight loss is relatively easy compared to weight loss maintenance. And so we got to hack the sustainability code. And I think a lot of it is going to be leveraging what the people already like to do.
Totally. You know, the other thing that I wanted to get your take on, because I think you had a previous guest where you guys talked about different preparation methods for food and the pros and cons about that, and how some vegetables you might, you know, extract some of the nutrients out and you're not getting the benefit, whereas others you increase absorption, it's going to be beneficial. I think a lot of times people think that, oh, so, you know, again, like we're both South Asian, and so everything is about heavy cooking and all these vegetables and whatnot. And that's part of our culture. And so when you start having salads and that kind of stuff, it's a bit foreign if, you know, your parents are immigrants and whatnot. And that can be problematic too at home, right? Trying to implement that with your loved ones. And that's because growing up, you're told, oh, look, you know, as in its natural state, like you got to eat the lettuce, you know, you pull it out of the ground and eat it. That's going to be how it's going to be most nutritious. Well, that turns out that's not really true. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's kind of a trip how varied it is. It varies based on which vegetable that we're talking about. It varies based on the cooking style and the duration. It also varies based on the nutrient. So sometimes cooking will increase the nutrient in the item that you're about to eat. And sometimes it will increase it in broccoli, but decrease it in watercress. I mean, you pick your combination of it out there. I mean, it's all over the map. And this is definitely one of those things that I'm like, okay, we're in the weeds. We're in the weeds. Because now it's going to come back to sustainability. Let's just say for fun, that it is most ideal and optimum to only eat everything raw. okay, cool, well, check in with me in 4 days and you're going to be on to a different diet or not doing it anymore. We like foods in different ways such that we want to encourage people to not be so stuck on, well, gosh, I have to do everything steamed or I have to do everything raw. Thankfully, the science shows that it doesn't actually work out so simply. But also just from a sustainability perspective, who's going to stick to it? I wouldn't stick to like the all raw veggie diet. I mean, we like variety, so we're going to have some of that in the diet.
Absolutely. And then, you know, another important thing, it's difficult, right? And the other conversation that sometimes goes hand in hand with that is talking about organic versus non-organic. And, you know, you've got the Dirty Dozen list, you've got different things. And the other problem is like when you think about the type of people who are consuming some of this content, yet maybe they don't come from a situation where they live in an affluent neighborhood or they're coming to a privileged situation where they can afford some of these, you know, methods of cooking. Maybe they can't air fry, right? Maybe what's only thing that's available to them is the one pan that's not stainless steel, right? That's whatever it might be. And that's the best that they got. And now they're hearing all this information about, no, this is the best way to do it. Where, you know, and, you know, again, the initial thought the person has, well, okay, well, if I'm not going to be able to get it and I'm not getting any benefit from that, then I might as well eat the fries. They're cheaper anyway, right? And so the other thing that I think that is worth emphasizing and for us to talk a little bit about is like there are food deserts all across the country, right? And so food scarcity, food deserts, and just the availability of or the misconception of how eating healthy is more expensive, it's more challenging. You know, one of the reasons, as I've already teed up, it's because of misconceptions. But how do you communicate with people about that? Because you also, I think, talked about in terms of like sometimes like you show examples of the frozen sometimes is better and how it's preserved and even more healthy. So I'd love to get your take on that, because I think sometimes people get anxiety about this too.
Yeah, there tends to be a lot of pushback about eating healthy is expensive. And there certainly are food deserts and there certainly are certain socioeconomic stresses that I can't really speak to. I don't have enough experience with the population or all of the struggles that they face. And so there are going to be some different conversations around that and the best that you can do given what you have, which is typically going to come down to keeping the quantity in line. I mean, even if you have to eat more processed stuff, what we want to do is try to eat the appropriate calories and macronutrients. Turns out a lot of our food supply is also fortified just for the reason that, you know, quality has decreased such that there's a very good chance that people eating a good amount of processed food won't necessarily be deficient in nutrients. But anyway, I think there's a lot that people can do that is very inexpensive with really nutritious stuff. I mean, we're talking oatmeal, tuna, potatoes, bananas, carrots, milk even. I mean, eggs. There's some really, really nutritious basic stuff that, you know, once we're talking about prices that you can get at Walmart or Aldi, you're just not going to get much lower than that. And yet they're so full of value. They're so full of nutrition value that you can have some spinach. I mean, gosh, there's so many things that you can reach what you need to on a very low budget. Now you are going to have to probably do some preparation style because, you know, you're not going to eat raw oatmeal and tuna every day with some spices and stuff. But I think I think there are certain segments of the population where the excuse is it's just too expensive. Or I'm sorry, that saying it's too expensive is kind of just an excuse.
Do you give any credit to like the whole Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15? I think it is. Is that just for your personal thing? Do you shop like that? I'm curious.
I don't. I used to. I also used to have a high amount of anxiety around my food and went all the clean route and stuff like that. You know, I went through what the EPA does to regulate pesticide exposure in terms of how they set limits. I looked at the data that they collect annually to see what's the residue on crops and even what's in meat and stuff like that in terms of hormones. And I've also looked at the independent research of what it says about eating organic. And I just don't think the fear is there. Now, interestingly enough, I do think people may decide to choose organic more for environmental reasons or more for ethical reasons or more even just like I want to support the local business reason, right? So there can be other reasons that people are choosing organic. But this idea that organic is always healthier, it's not true from the standpoint of what's actually in the crop, because that is often variable based on the soil type, how much sun the tomato got during the season, all of that stuff. Not just necessarily whether or not it's organic or not. So there's this idea that organic is always more nutritious, and that's not the case at all. And then what we see the data say about harm, it's not really there either. What's also really interesting about the organic claim, you know, if 80 to 90% of people aren't eating enough fruits and vegetables, why are we so concerned about the exposure that we're not exposed to? Which is always makes me pause too. Like, everyone's worried about organic fruits and vegetables. It's like, but we're not eating them. So how is that working out?
Yeah. Missing the forest for the trees, right? So I know we've spent, I guess, coming up close to an hour, and we've talked a lot about nutrition. Of course, that's what you're the domain expert on, but that's not all you talk about, right? You talk about just kind of the sustainable, healthy lifestyle. And there are different facets, different levers that we can pull on. I guess this is one of your favorite things to say. It's never one thing. And you emphasized sleep is important. And depending on the individual, maybe nutrition isn't the most important to think about. Maybe for that person, the low-hanging fruit is going to be just to optimize their sleep and get them to that 7 hours. Maybe just to get some movement throughout the day. And so, yeah, this conversation is about nutrition. But again, I want to caution people to think about, just look at your situation. And maybe that's not where you need the most help. It is certainly the most challenging out of all, I shouldn't say majority of the conversations that I have, just because I think you might have mentioned this last time, it's 24/7, right? Like, so if you're up 16 hours out of the day, you're making either decisions to put something in your mouth or to not put something in your mouth, right? If you're awake in some form or fashion. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for slip ups, so to speak.
I saw an article that said, I think we make 250 diet-related decisions a day. Because it's not just, am I going to eat it or not? How much am I going to have? Am I going to pair it with something else? How long until I have it? I mean, they're 250. So yeah, I mean, it's constant where things like exercise and even sleep can be better compartmentalized.
That begs, I'm thinking about this, right? So something that I've heard recently, a lot of coaches and experts talk about this is, at least successful people, is like, minimize the variability day to day. Because then you don't have to go through that decision fatigue. Can you talk a little bit about that? Are you familiar with any literature where they've looked at that?
Well, the study that was citing that, they were talking about the importance of what the default decision is. And I think that's kind of where you're going, less decisions or decision fatigue. And so they were linking it to set up your food environment such that the default decision is to eat the whole foods and not the processed stuff. And so this is... yeah, I mean, it's exactly in line with a lot of the recommendations that you'll hear from me and as a lot of other people. It's like, make it really easy to eat the fruits and vegetables and make it really hard to overeat on the ice cream. I mean, it's one of the best lines of defenses we have. Like, what's there and available to eat? You're more likely to eat it when you're hungry. And if you've got ice cream in the freezer, you're more likely to go after that. They were doing, though, in this study, it was actually really interesting. They were ending up talking about nutrition, but they used surveys or, you know, like if you were to go to get your driver's license, you have to say yes to whether or not you're going to be an organ donor. They were saying how the default decision really skewed the amount of people that were willing to donate the organs. That it was like, oh, if the form was such that you had to check no, they actually had more people opt in because the default was that it was blank or something like that. So just a really cool paper to say, okay, if we've got 250 of these diet-related decisions a day, I mean, yes, don't have any of the stuff that you're going to binge on around the house, because probably more than one of those are not going to be a positive decision. We've got so many chances for error, right?
Yeah. Again, I go back to blaming kids. That's it's not cooperative to that right there. So I love her. I love her so much.
I don't have the answer for that.
Yeah. Well, EC, this has been amazing. I want to thank you so much again for all the work you did for dealing with our technical difficulties here and sticking around and coming back and just for the good work that you do. I think Optimize Me Nutrition, pretty much on all platforms, right? The Consistency Project on your podcast channels. So we'll link all that. Two questions for you. I'll ask one, Darsh, can you finish it up? I'm excited to hear what you are excited about in this. And it doesn't have to be nutrition, right? We talked about some of the dangers and pitfalls and stuff that concerns us. But what are you excited about that's going on right now in the world of health and fitness, nutrition, coaching, and maybe even the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think I'm going to stay pretty small scale. It's when I work with my clients, when I am able to see real change on the individual level, when they come back and they're like, I'm either seeing X result or I understand this enough that I don't need another nutrition coach, or I feel so free. I feel so empowered. All of those things are really awesome and really inspire me to kind of keep going and keep working on nutrition. So that's what I get excited about, really working with my clients.
Awesome. Well, EC, I want to thank you as well. I think your podcast not only helps to educate us, but it allows us to then teach others. And I think that's what a lot of the true value is, you know, telling others not to get so caught up in the nuances of what we see on social media and really just zooming out. So absolutely love that approach. And I think that's what people will take away from this episode and your first one with us. But our last question, as we ask everyone, and I honestly do not remember what you said the first time. So excited to hear what you say about this.
We did not ask her this question.
I was going to say, I didn't actually remember that. Okay.
We didn't ask her. So this is the first one.
Okay. Yeah. We must've incorporated a little bit later then. All right. So first time asking this is, how do we put the health back in healthcare?
That's the last question. Oh man.
There's another hour.
I know. How much time do you guys have? No. Oh man. I think I have an unpopular opinion on this one. I just don't think it's on the shoulders of doctors. I think doctors have an enormous service, and I think that somehow currently they're also expected to be what my profession is and what wellness coaches are doing and other nutrition coaches are doing, when really habit and lifestyle changes, it's hard and it takes time. I think the statistic is like, it's a median of 66 days to make a diet or lifestyle change. I mean, how is that going to work in our current system? So I don't know. I don't know that I really have a good answer, because I mean, I think some of what the system does right now is incredibly powerful. I think what we're looking at is, how do we promote health? And how do we get people to buy into health? And I just don't think that's through the existing system, but I don't know that the existing system is wrong for what it needs to do as well. I actually, I don't know, this is probably a little bit of a tangent, but there's the whole idea about whether processed foods are addictive. If they have, you know, are they, you know, addictive, like, are they a true addiction, all of that stuff. If they end up being able to show that they have, you know, some level of addiction, and food addiction is a real diagnosable standard, then we can put regulations around it. And I believe that limiting the food environment, not totally, we can all eat this processed stuff. You guys know I'm not an absolutist, but I think that's some of the ways that we can put the health back in healthcare, because we have to make this stuff less accessible for people. We have to make the default decision easier for them. And I don't know how we're going to do that on a society level. It's certainly not going to happen by 15-minute appointments with your primary care.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of, you know, talks about taxing sodas at a higher price and taxing the sugary drinks and things, but, you know, nothing has yet to come to fruition in that sense. But I totally agree with you. For one, I think there kind of is this schism where you have us doctors in this healthcare really just putting those acute patients and trying to get them healthier. But it's funny, because I tell a lot of my residents, I was just telling medical students today that, you know, once I finish residency, my goal's kind of to get out of the traditional healthcare system and really be that life coach, be that wellness coach, and be that doctor that can promote health, and really try to fit myself in a system that can do that to put the health back in healthcare. So totally agree with everything you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And just an add-on that sugar tax thing. I think I love the intent. I don't think the sting is there. Either they're going to go over to the next town or the next state line, or it's just not enough on a single beverage to make the habit change. Where something like, if we sold processed foods only in grocery stores, and you can't get them at the drugstore, and you can't get them at the TV store, and you can't get them at the FedEx store, whatever it is, start limiting some of that stuff. I think that would be really interesting. Kind of like cigarettes, you know, we kind of made them hard to get. Can we do something similar here? But anyway, that's where I go, which probably wasn't the answer you were thinking.
Well, that's great. I love the perspective. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning into the show this week. Thank you again to the doctors over at Medicine Redefined. Thanks for that great conversation. Thanks for sharing it with us so that we can share it with you. If you have not yet, please do subscribe to the Consistency Project podcast wherever you're listening to this. That will ensure you don't miss another episode. And if you have subscribed and you have been listening, hey, thanks. Leave us a review or a rating. That helps new folks know that the show is worth their time. Thank you. EC and I will be back next week for a new episode of the Consistency Project Podcast.